From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Throughout much of human history, marriage has had very little to do with love. In prehistoric times, it had more to do with building tribal alliances and turning enemies into kinfolk. People married for economic and political gain. Then, in the 18th century, the love revolution took the concept of marriage in an entirely different direction. The rise of modern marriage embraced the emotional values of intimacy and fidelity. Love took center stage, and people soon found themselves choosing to remain single or to divorce if they fell out of love. Marriage would never be the same, and many would say for the better. But with the expectation of romance came an unexpected fragility for the institution itself. Tonight on Point, love and marriage, how they became forever intertwined. Later this hour, Donald Rumsfeld testifies before the Senate Armed Services Committee on why he will not set a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. But first, the history of saying, I do. What does marriage mean to you? Is it about making a true love match, or are there other factors involved? Is there still any good reason to get married? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Seattle, Washington, is Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College and director of research on public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of the new book, Marriage, a History, From Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage. Welcome, Stephanie.
Oh, my pleasure, Gail. Thank you.
So you say this is not the book you started out to write. How so?
Well, I've spent a lot of my career researching family history, trying to explain to people that a lot of things that we think are new are in fact very traditional, and a lot of things we think are traditional are actually very exotic and new. And so when people first started asking me about marriage, I was inclined to say, you know, it's the same thing, that single-parent families and step-families were much more common in the past because of high death rates, that there's been an extraordinary variety of family arrangements and sexual arrangements. We think we're more open-minded today. Some of them would put our hair standing on end. And we think of things like the traditional love match or the traditional male breadwinner family. Those, in fact, were very, very new inventions. But as I started to answer these questions, I began to think to myself, a sort of nagging suspicion, maybe there's not anything totally new, and maybe some things that you think are traditional are really new. However, I think I'm missing the forest for the trees here. In fact, marriage has begun to play a totally different role in society and in people's personal lives than ever before. So I kind of had to throw out my preconceptions, start over, and begin to understand. I went way back in history to figure out where did marriage begin to change and why.
Well, not going quite all the way back. Why is it, you know, it's so interesting, the pictures we carry in our heads. Why is it, do you think, that many people assume there was a golden past, perhaps one they just missed by a little bit, and that one was filled with good marriages? Everybody was happy, you know, life was serene. It was a good thing.
Every generation feels that. I think marriage and family life in general serve as a lightning rod for people's anxieties. And, you know, because we look back at the past and we tend to white out the unpleasantness, we get all these romantic notions of how obedient kids used to be, of how stable marriages used to be. And every generation, as far back as the ancient Romans, has been complaining that the previous generation had better marriages, more obedient kids, and things were going to hell in a handbasket.
When did love-based marriage actually begin? And was there some kind of turning point where that became acceptable as opposed to a threat to the social order?
Yes, I think there was a very sharp turning point. And the invention of the idea that people should marry for love was much later than I initially thought. Because, of course, throughout the ages, you have young people who wanted to fall in love, the Romeo and Juliet story. But it's interesting that almost all ancient love stories are tragedies. They don't end with the happy wedding the way the sitcom does today. They end with the parting of the couple who really love each other into having to marry to someone else, or them dying a tragic death because they won't marry someone else. And throughout history, I was really surprised to see how hostile most societies were to the notion that people should marry for love. Some people said you should fall in love after you're married. That's a good thing. Other people, like the aristocracy of medieval Europe, said, no, really, the only true love can exist in an adulterous affair. But whatever the approach to love after marriage was, societies through the ages agreed that love was a threat to marriage, that if you allowed young people to marry on the basis of something as irrational as love, the society would come crashing down around you. You needed love to create alliances, as you were saying at the beginning of the program, to conduct economic and political mergers, to increase your family labor force. So it was only in the 18th century, in the late 18th century, that this began to be respectable, and only in Western Europe and North America, that people began to say, look, the ideas of the Enlightenment, the ideas of the American Revolution, the older generation shouldn't tell the younger generation what to do. We should let them have some choice. And after all, people are entitled to the pursuit of happiness, to be able to have fulfilling lives. And this was a radical new idea that many people felt immediately would lead to disaster.
Well, and in fact, was it a simpler thing when marriage was essentially a business decision?
Well, it was a simpler thing. Whether or not it was a better thing or a happier thing is quite a different matter. I researched these love stories of the past, like Anthony and Cleopatra, which turned out to be just totally murderous, ruthless alliances for political and economic reasons. And in fact, we find that many of these marriages that were for economic and political reasons were extremely volatile, extremely unhappy. There was a lot of abuse. There was a lot of discontent. So the institution was certainly stronger when people kind of had to be married. It was chosen for them. They didn't have much choice as to how they behaved. But the relationship of marriage was certainly not better than it is today.
Well, and certainly one of the more thought-provoking statements you make in this book is about how relations between men and women have changed more in the past 30 years than the previous 3,000. But I wonder if one response to that might be, well, hasn't everything? You know, why should marriage be any different?
Well, that's a good point. It has changed. And why do we think that marriage shouldn't be any different? And in fact, it's not so, you know, it's surprising in a sense that it comes as a surprise. But I think we had two changes in the history of marriage that really began to converge in the 70s and 80s and left almost everybody kind of traumatized. You know, first was the invention of the love match, and no sooner did you get the invention of the love match than divorce rates began to rise, and the unwillingness for a woman to enter a shotgun marriage began to rise. But nevertheless, that was kind of held in check because, in fact, you might have these ideals about love, but business arrangements and practicality continued to prevail right up until the 1950s and 60s. Women were economically dependent, so they basically had to marry and they had to stay married, except under very exceptional circumstances. And the other big change is that they were legally subordinate to men. So there wasn't much to fight about in a marriage as long as a man had the right to imprison or beat you, as he did till the very end of the 19th century, and as long as the laws held, as they did until the 1970s, most young people are really surprised to find this out, that most states had head and master laws saying that if there was a difference of opinion about where the family should live, the man got to decide, the woman had no right. So somehow between 1960 and 1980, women got reliable birth control. We repealed the worst stigma of the very harsh legal penalties for illegitimacy. I think that was an important humanitarian reform, but it also decreased the pressure on women to marry someone she didn't love if she got pregnant. Then you had the development of new legal rights saying that men and women had the right to be equals in a relationship. And finally, you got the influx of women into the workforce, their increasing winning of equal pay. And within 20 years, you had what I've come to think of as the perfect storm that just changed all the terms of marriage, you know, irrevocably.
And how much is this true around the world? Is this a uniquely American phenomenon, or is marriage seen to be in a state of crisis elsewhere?
it's happening everywhere, these changes. They take different forms. They come at different times and at different paces in different countries. For example, just last month, Saudi Arabia finally got around to saying that a father could not force his daughter to marry someone of his choosing. In many countries, there are very transitional kinds of things. There's still arranged marriages, for example, in large parts of India and Asia, but more and more young people are at least getting veto power. The changing role of women is another international phenomenon. The women have been entering the workforce and the education system all around the globe since the late 1960s. The only place where that was turned back in the 1990s was in Afghanistan under the Taliban. And as women get more education, they postpone the age of marriage. They get more control of their fertility. Fertility rates have been falling. They get more access to the workforce. Women are saying that they want to change the traditional terms of marriage. One of the most interesting things is that in societies where women's equality is less developed than ours, you might think that, oh, well, they're still marrying more. Actually, they're marrying less. Where women don't have the right to leave marriage and where they don't have the right to negotiate, they're actually on a huge marriage strike in Japan, Italy, Spain. The policymakers are terrified that women will just refuse to get married and they won't have enough kids to keep their societies going.
So much of this does sound counterintuitive, doesn't it? We're talking this hour about the evolution and changing role of marriage with historian Stephanie Kuntz. What does modern marriage in America look like to you? Is it a far cry from what your parents or your grandparents expected from their lifelong partnerships? Or perhaps is it surprisingly similar? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with historian Stephanie Kuntz about her new book, Marriage, A History, From Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage. Do you celebrate where we've come in this country on the question of marriage, or do you worry that traditional values are being left behind? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to the phone lines to Siler City, North Carolina. We want to hear from Steve. Hello, Steve.
Hello. Hi.
Welcome.
This is so ironic. I just purchased a engagement ring about 10 minutes ago, and I turned your show on that I listen to from time to time, and this is so ironic.
So you're a believer.
I am a believer, yeah. In my little opinion that I have, I agree that marriage is one of the most important aspects of civilization. It is a union between two people that I don't know. I am a believer. I'm a little lost for words. But.
Well, understandably so, what you just did, Steve. Thank you so much, and congratulations.
You're welcome.
Stephanie Kuntz, why is it that we hear stories like Steve, and you just can't stop the impulse to say, oh, isn't that nice?
Well, I think marriage is the highest expression of commitment that we can imagine in this society. And there is something very moving about people wanting to make that commitment and to invite other people into it to say, take an interest in our relationship. I think that's a very moving thing. And, when you said earlier, is this good or bad? I think the changes that we've had are good and bad. And one of the things that was really hard for me to wrap my head around originally, and I think it's very hard for all of us to realize that you can't just pick and choose from historical changes what you like and get rid of what you don't like, that the very things that have made marriage fairer, more fulfilling, as you say, more intimate, more fidelity. We have higher notions of fidelity and fairness than people in the past ever did. But those very same things have also made marriage more optional. And whether we like this or not, they've meant that some people find a marriage that doesn't live up to those expectations less bearable. So the two have come together hand in hand.
Would returning to a more traditional view of marriage strengthen it as an institution?
Well, no, I don't think that it would. Certainly, we need to work on how we understand commitments, how we develop our expectations of love in realistic ways rather than those that are fanned by the, you know, the popular culture and the romanticization. But these changes in marriage affect everyone, whatever your values and whatever, however much you want to live in a traditional family or do live in a traditional family, think you live in a traditional family, we've all been changed by the economic and legal independence of women, by the rising age of marriage, which incidentally is good for marriage. Marriages contracted at 25 or over are less likely to divorce than young marriages. But the fact that more and more people are postponing marriage means that increasingly many young people begin their sex lives outside of marriage and incur obligations outside of marriage. So I think that if we try to reimpose so-called traditional values, many of which I show in my book are not really traditional, in a context of such change, you can often do some harm. Let me give you a good example, and that is that the highest divorce rates in America take place in many sections of the Bible Belt. Evangelical Christians have just as high divorce rates as atheists or agnostics. And one reason for the high divorce rates in the Bible Belt is that people with very so-called traditional values about sexual morality and that you should be married before you have sex tend to rush into marriage earlier, which, as I said, is a higher risk factor for divorce. So I think that this idea that somehow we can shoehorn everybody back to the past if we just say, let's revive traditional values, I think we have to pick and choose very carefully and not kid ourselves that we could turn the clock back.
Well, and is it simply unrealistic to expect that people can live happily ever after with the same person year in and year out, given all the other changes that confront us over time? Because what you want at 18 or 25 or 30 may be very different than what you want 10 or 20 years later.
Yes, well, it's not totally unrealistic to think that people can learn to change and grow together. And in fact, there's wonderful new research that's coming out that shows what it takes to predict a long-lasting, stable marriage. But you know, what you say is true. Living together till death do us part is a bigger challenge than generations of the past ever had to reach. And especially living together with two people who can leave, who both have equal legal rights to negotiate, it means that you have to work harder at your marriages. You have to be very planful and intentional about how your marriages changes in a way that you never had to in the past.
I wonder if you'd share your personal story with us as well, because it certainly illustrates the fact that women in particular, have many more options than they did at one time.
Well, historians are always scared to talk about themselves, but I figured I owed it to people, if I was going to talk about marriage, to explain my own marital past. To do it properly, I have to start with my parents. I grew up with my mother, a 1950s housewife, who had given up her job during World War II to become a full-time housewife, but who had a husband. Now, I adored my father. He was a great husband, but he was not he was a great father. He was not a very good husband. He drank too much. He was very impatient and critical. But my mom stayed with him and stayed with him and stayed with him until we got off to college. And the result was I went off to college with the sense that, oh my goodness, you know, people can lose their identity in marriage. Women can get really worn down by marriage. When she divorced him, she blossomed. And so I approached my own adulthood with considerable suspicion of marriage. Now, my mother went on to remarry and to have another 20-year marriage that was just joyful and exciting and, you know, I mean, my stepfather was the best thing that ever happened to her. But I remained very suspicious of marriage. And I met my, when I was in graduate school, I met the man that I really fell in love with. And we went out together for many years, but it was uneven. I was too much in love with him in a certain sense. And it was an uneven relationship, and we broke up when I took a teaching job in 1975. So we did not get back together again until 12 years later. And by that time, I had been engaged to be married, and that had fallen through. And at age 35, I found myself pregnant and decided that I didn't want to have an abortion. I wanted, this was my last chance to have a kid. So I went through a period of being a single mom. Then my ex-boyfriend came back into my life. And this time, I think because I was so much older, the relationship was so much more even. I think that our marriage has been so much better than it would have been if I had married at age 21 when I really, really wanted to at the time. So I use the story with some embarrassment, but to say that more and more it's possible to have a good outcome via a very non-traditional route, and also you may enter a very traditional route and you may not have a good outcome. You can't predict anymore, I think, as well as you used to be able to, what kind of a life people have by what kind of values they espouse and what their, and whether their marital history has been real traditional.
I want to go to Elizabeth now, who's on the line from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I actually followed a non-traditional route. I'm 30 years old, and I have two children, and I'm getting married in a couple of weeks to a man that isn't there father, but I'm madly in love with him, and the kids are, and he's madly in love with the kids. And I guess back to the point you were just making, I never would have predicted that things might work out better this way for me, because the added benefit is, after having been a single mom for 7 years, I get to see and choose who my children's father will be. Their biological father is very much involved in their life, but it doesn't change the fact of being a single parent. So I got the benefit of choosing a great dad for them and a great partner for myself by going the non-traditional route. And we're having a backyard barbecue wedding in a couple of weeks, and I'm really thrilled.
So as you were growing up, did you ever imagine the time would come when you would make that kind of choice to have children but not marry their father?
Not at all. And my parents are somewhat traditional. I mean, they're liberal-minded, so they were very helpful in helping me through my decision. My children are twins, actually, so it was sort of a double surprise. and they were really very helpful and very open-minded about my decision, but no, I never would have thought that I would have been in that situation. And there were some social pressures. You know, like your guest said, some embarrassment at first. But like I said, now I realize it's all working out for the better. And had I done a shotgun-type wedding, I don't think that I would have been as happy. And of course, like she also said, you gain so much experience over time that now I'm able to make good decisions for my kids and for myself in creating a partnership and creating a family. So it's working out quite well.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth. And I would imagine, Stephanie, you probably hear a lot of stories like this as you were gathering material for your book.
I do. I've taken many oral histories. My students either write oral histories of their own, take oral histories of their family, or they often write their own. And it's just stunning to me what you look at the complexity. And you get, you know, and it gets us past this liberal-conservative divide. Oh, all these changes are wonderful, you know, and everything's to be celebrated on the one hand, or all these changes are terrible, and if people only had more traditional values, you know, life is just so much more complex than that. And I try to show in my history book why it's more complex than that, and why I think we can realistically say, you know, no, very few people choose single motherhood, and you know, by say that, well, that's the ideal way to raise kids. But you know, life is complicated, and it's more complicated as we've developed more choices. And I think we have to figure out a way of helping people be responsible in whatever family form they end up in or go through on the way there.
Well, with so many other choices, does marriage still matter? Is there any good reason to do it?
Oh, yes, I think marriage does still matter to Americans. Now, there are places where it matters less. For example, in Scandinavia, there's a lot of people who go their whole lives without marriage, or they have two kids first and then marry, not because they've chosen a different partner, but because they're just in no hurry. And there's many more unwed moms in Scandinavia than there are in the United States. But here's what's interesting. There are fewer single moms. A lot of these are born, these unwed, you know, births are to mothers who are cohabiting with their partners. So they, for them, marriage, I think, is less momentous than it is for us Americans. For Americans still, most Americans see marriage as the highest expression of commitment they can make. But because of changing social and economic roles, it increasingly becomes something that people are not willing to commit to until they're completely sure that this is going to be the right partnership. So a lot of the people who are postponing marriage or having the kind of marital history that your last caller was talking about are doing it because they've seen what happens to people entering shotgun marriages. They've experienced divorce. They don't want that to happen. And now that they don't have to enter marriage, they are actually being much more cautious and making sure that it's the outcome of a good relationship, not the kind of hopeful beginning. We may like that or not like that decision, but I'm afraid in today's world, that's a decision people are going to continue to make, and we need to learn to deal with it. But no, I don't think marriage is dead. In fact, the divorce rate has come down by about 26% since its big height late 1970s, early 1980s. And that divorce rate just spiked right after women joined the workforce and began making some demands on their husbands to change. I think one reason it's come down is that more men and women are learning better how to negotiate marriage under the new gender rules and possibilities that we have.
I want to hear from Kaz now. He's on the line from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hello, Kaz.
Hi, good evening, ladies. I want to say this is a great conversation. I think it's awesome. One thing I was wondering is how do you explain love, and it almost seems like more of an emotional, a passionate, love at first sight. I've always understood love as being an emotion, but you can say I love a pizza. You know, people say I love my bike, I love my car, but that's not the same love that's required in a marriage. I'm getting married in October. My fiance, an absolutely wonderful woman. I'll be the first one to tell you, I'm in love with her in the emotional, passion state, but there's so much more to that. There's the sacrificial love where I see her as, when I make decisions, it's on our behalf, no longer just, me, Kaz, as an individual, as a man, just saying, hey, you know, what's best for me? And I think that's where I've seen just other marriages. I'm not an expert, but in what I've experienced and when that's where it came about, is in that sacrificial component.
Kaz, thanks so much for the call.
I would just really want to agree with that. In the past, marriage was a sacrificing for often only one-sided sacrifice. The woman had to sacrifice for the man, or both the man and woman had to sacrifice for their family ambition. So today, when we talk about the love match, the positive aspect of that occurs when people do exactly what Kaz says, that they combine the passion and the love and the attraction with a very deep friendship. In fact, I would argue, I'm not a psychologist, I don't try to play one, but I look at the psychological research that I had to consult to do the last couple chapters of my book, and I filter it through kind of my study of history. And the one piece of advice I'd be willing to actually go on record and say is that it is more important for men and women to begin their marriage as friends than it's ever been before in history, because they do have to negotiate. They are individuals. It used to be kind of you fell in love with a gender role. Here's a manly man. He'll take care of me. I must love him. Here's a womanly woman. She'll raise my kids. Boy, she looks like she's a good housekeeper. Nowadays, the roles are so much in flux that you have to really like your partner as well as love them.
Friendship lasts. But what really goes on beneath the surface of choosing a mate? I mean, how much of what we describe as love is actually some kind of unconscious choosing of a partner who's probably very much like us in terms of education and social standing?
Oh, well, certainly that's true. And there are always complex reasons. People, you know, look for somebody that they think they can live with, they think they can be compatible with. And you put your finger on a very interesting set of changes that are going on. In fact, there's great increase in interracial and interreligious marriages over the past 50 years. But there's actually been a decrease in marriages between people of really different educational levels and very different incomes. And I think that's partly because men and women are now able to look for different things than they were 50 years ago. It used to be that men really valued somebody who was a housekeeper. They were much more interested in being the boss and being the male breadwinner and being in charge. And now we find that men are really interested in finding someone with the same education, whereas women are less interested in getting a good provider than someone who can really communicate and be their friend.
Well, hold the thought. We're going to continue our discussion after we take a break. We're talking this hour about the history of marriage, what it has meant in the past, and what it means today. Are today's marriages a true reflection of equal partnership? Does marriage still mean as much as it once did? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with historian Stephanie Kuntz about love, marriage, and how they became intertwined. Her new book is Marriage, A History, From Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage. Let's go to Groton, Massachusetts now. We have Greg on the line. Hello, Greg.
How you doing tonight?
Very well, thanks.
Good, good. So I was just listening to the program on my way home from work this evening, and you know, the timing is somewhat impeccable, I guess. So I think I can, I don't know, maybe shed some light on the 31-year-old male side of the equation here.
Tell us your story.
recently being probably in the last 2 weeks, evolving over the last 2 months, the issue of marriage became a major point of contention in a relationship with an absolutely fantastic woman who I've known for, oh, 8 or so years. So I guess the friends first thing is certainly at play here, like you were just talking about. You know, the pressures, it's something that I think girls, women, are brought up to think about from a very early age. And, you know, us guys, we're out in the backyard burning things and getting into trouble and all that. We're not really thinking about it till we're sort of forced to, and I think that just becomes an issue. And I've seen a lot of my friends just sort of walk into a relationship and sort of talk themselves into, I think, the whole marriage issue.
Into it or out of it, Greg. Thanks. Yeah. We're running a little short on time, so I wanted to put that to Stephanie. That is the stereotype, right, of the eager bride and the reluctant groom.
Yes, although we're finding that it's actually more women than men today say that marriage is not necessarily their ideal lifestyle. And although many women do romanticize their early years of marriage and their wedding day, one very interesting thing that holds true is that men tend to become, even if they're kind of need to be pushed into it, like your caller said, they tend to become more contented with marriage over time, whereas women tend to become less contented. I think we can work to decrease that discontent, but it's an interesting irony, and it is women who initiate the majority of divorces.
Well, and here's another interesting factoid that you uncovered, that spousal murders and suicides both drop when divorce is more readily available. So it makes you wonder, should we make it harder to get married and easier to get divorced?
Well, it certainly calls into question the idea that there's some quick fix to this. If we could just repeal no-fault divorce, for example, every state that adopted it saw a 20% decline in the suicide rate of wives and an even larger decline in the homicide rates of wives. Wives against husbands, you know, which is not to say there weren't problems, but there were also some lives saved by this.
And why do you think that intimacy has become so important in relationships?
Well, I think that for good and bad reasons. For good reasons, because we in fact do have these higher expectations of marriage. It may mean that some people are more willing to walk away, but it means that many people are willing to work harder than ever before, and we are interested in becoming friends, and that means sharing our intimate thoughts. There's another side to it that I think that is more of a little of problematic in working out a good marriage, and that is that as we live in a more impersonal society, as sort of the commitments to live in the same place, to be able to have the same job, to be able to count on your pension, to draw from the recent news reports, as those have broken down, we put more of our emotional eggs in the basket of our partner. We sort of seek a refuge from the storm. And while that can be very satisfying, it can also create a kind of pressure cooker situation that's not good for your marriage.
In the couple of seconds we have left, you've seen such changes in the past 30 years. Will there be even more in the next 30, or are we about where we are likely to remain?
I think we've stabilized, that things have leveled off, that we're never going to go back to lifelong marriage organizing everybody's life, but that people will continue to get married, and we can even save more marriages than we do. But we have to come to terms with these changes and learn also how to make divorce and stepfamilies and all of these other arrangements work better, as long as well as helping married couples stay together.
Stephanie Kuntz, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Her new book is Marriage, A History from Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Donald Rumsfeld and members of the Senate Armed Services Committee lock horns over the Iraq War. This is On Point. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and some of the Pentagon's top brass were on the hot seat over Iraq today during a tense hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee. There have been daily attacks in Iraq. Popular support in America for the war is plummeting, and some in Congress have called for a timetable for withdrawal of troops. But Rumsfeld told senators that the American military must stay the course.
Some in Congress have suggested that deadlines be set. That would be a mistake, as Senator Levin has said. It would throw a lifeline to terrorists who in recent months have suffered significant losses and casualties, been denied havens, and suffered weakened popular support.
But many of the senators were not convinced and had some tough questions for the secretary and his generals. Joining me now with a look at today's hearings is Anthony Cordesman, a former director of intelligence assessment at the Pentagon. He's written a series of books on the lessons of modern war and holds the chair in strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't we listen together to a little bit more of the testimony, this from Senator Carl Levin. He was speaking to General John Abizaid, commander of U.S. Central Command, about whether he agrees with Vice President Cheney's recent assessment that the insurgency in Iraq is in its last throes.
General Abizaid, can you give us your assessment of the strength of the insurgency? Is it less strong, more strong, about the same strength as it was 6 months ago?
In terms of comparison from 6 months ago, in terms of foreign fighters, I believe there are more foreign fighters coming into Iraq than there were 6 months ago. In terms of the overall strength of the insurgency, I'd say it's about the same as it was.
So you wouldn't agree with the statement that it's in its last throes?
I don't know that I would make any comment about that other than to say there's a lot of work to be done against the insurgency.
Well, the Vice President has said it's in its last throes. That's the statement of the Vice President. It doesn't sound to me from your testimony or any other testimony here this morning that it is in its last throes, but...
I'm sure you'll forgive me from criticizing the Vice President.
Now, I just want an honest assessment from you as to whether you agree with a particular statement of his. It's not personal. I just want to know whether you agree with that assessment.
So, Anthony Cordesman, what's your opinion of where we are?
I think General Lebezade provided a very accurate description. I just come back from Iraq. I did not find anyone at any level of command, whether in the military or in the embassy, who did not believe that this insurgency is going to go on for some years. General Lebezade quite correctly pointed out that there's been a shift in the patterns. There is at least some indication that the more secular, more Ba'ath-oriented Sunni insurgents have begun to think of more inclusive efforts of taking political options. But it is very clear that the more extreme Islamist insurgents have become far more violent, that the number of car bombings, the number of suicide bombings has gone way up. There certainly is no reduction in the number of attacks or casualties. Those have gone up very seriously. And quite honestly, without getting into the details, I cannot conceive that the Vice President ever saw any intelligence report from any source that could conceivably have justified the statement he made.
Well, Secretary Rumsfeld rejected one senator's description of the Iraq War as a quagmire. Is there a better word? Rumsfeld said that was fundamentally inconsistent with the facts.
You know, the problem is this is politics, not analysis. What you do see, I think, is a situation that has to be kept in perspective. You have a serious insurgent threat in four provinces. That's out of 18 provinces in the country. You have two to four others which have less stability. These are not minor areas. They include key cities like Basra and Mosul. But you do not have a nationwide insurgency. There are indications that the Sunnis are gradually beginning to accept the idea of participation in the government. Now, that's not certain. They may be driven towards civil war. That's one of the key goals of all of these suicide bombings. The main effort here is to provoke the Shiites and Kurds so much that it will divide the country and paralyze any hope. But the government is moving forward, and after some years of delay, you're really beginning to see Iraqi forces come online, not the kind that can fight the insurgents by themselves, but there was all of one deployable battalion in July of last year. There are 100 battalions active now, 80 of them in the army and 20 in the police, plus special forces. It's not clear. Whatever it is, it isn't a quagmire. The great uncertainty is whether the Iraqi political dimension can hold together and whether there's time enough to make the Iraqi forces fully effective. One form of civil war could make this hopeless. Political success plus Iraqi forces coming online could turn it into victory.
Well, as you suggested a moment ago, one question here, of course, is about what percentage of Iraqi forces might be combat ready. We have an exchange here between Republican Senator John McCain, who is chastising General George Casey, the commanding general for the multinational force in Iraq, for not answering his question about what percentage of Iraqi forces are combat ready.
We seem to have great difficulty, including redacting of information of in the Boeing thing, including failure to get other information that I find very frustrating. General Casey, I don't think it's an illegitimate nor should it be a classified answer. What percentage of those 170,000 are combat ready?
Okay. And I'm not...
We can proceed to a closed hearing. Follow
well,
this.
Then we'll proceed to a closed hearing. I think the American people need to know, Mr. Chairman, they're the ones who are paying for this conflict. I'll drop the question for now.
Anthony Cordesman, do you get the sense that Congress is getting a little impatient with the administration over this war?
I think it's very impatient, and it has reason to be. There's a much better story to tell when you visit Iraq than the administration seems capable of telling. One of the problems is that it simply delivers shallow ideological messages rather than providing the kind of detail and content that would reassure the Congress, the media, or the American people. I think General Casey, you quite correctly did not cite the readiness data to do it and break it out in meaningful ways, because manpower is meaningless. What really counts are the combat units. And to cite the readiness of those combat units would give some very clear messages to the insurgents. But I think one key element here is that virtually all of these forces can perform some kind of mission, and yet really almost none of them are fully ready to operate on their own. But I think it would probably be fair to say that if you were to read the readiness ratings for the Army, somewhere between 30% and 40% of the combat battalions that now exist really can perform a significant function, not handling the first-line missions of U.S. troops, but a very important capability. And if you look at the police forces, and these include commando battalions and mechanized battalions, not just ordinary police, the figure there would be well over a third can play a significant role in providing security for counterinsurgency. But beyond that, I think it would be probably unwise to get into any kind of detail as to the readiness of these forces.
Anthony Cordesman, we have one more clip that we want to play, and this is General Abizaid responding to a question from Senator John Ensign, a Republican of Nevada, about the importance of not losing American popular support for the war.
We that are fighting the war think it's a war worth fighting. We are making a huge difference. The people we're helping think that we are fighting a war that's worth fighting. We are making a huge difference. But we can't win the war. American soldiers can't win the war without your support and without the support of our people. We can't ignore the problem. We need to move together to understand it and fight it together.
Anthony, the most recent figures I've seen are from the Washington Post ABC News poll, which show nearly 6 in 10 Americans saying that the war was not worth fighting, more than 4 in 10 people believing the U.S. presence in Iraq is becoming analogous to the experience in Vietnam. Is it too late to find popular support for the war?
I don't believe so, but I, at this point, should probably say I'm a Republican. And I find that the administration has talked down to the Congress, talked down to the American people, has not provided the messages and reporting that the Congress has asked for. It has not made the case for what will be a matter of years of ongoing counterinsurgency activity, what will be hundreds, if not thousands, of more American lives, either killed or wounded, as well as far more Iraqi casualties, and costs in excess of $5 billion a month. There is a case, and a very good one, to be made. One case is that this is so strategically important that it affects a region with 60% of the world's proven oil reserves. It affects our economy, every job in America, and the global economy, that there is real progress in creating the Iraqi forces that can gradually replace U.S. forces, that the Iraqi government may fail, but it also may succeed in creating a democracy. But if the American people are to be persuaded, you cannot treat them or continue to treat them like idiots. You have to make the case in detail. You have to explain the fact that this is years of further commitment, and you have to go into a level of honesty where Americans can decide whether these risks are worth taking.
Anthony Cordesman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman is former director of intelligence assessment at the Pentagon. He's written a series of books on the lessons of modern war and holds the chair in strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joined us from Washington, D.C. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.